You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest, Christina Cleveland, is a social psychologist, public theologian, author, and professor based in Durham, North Carolina. Christina is author of Disunity in Christ, Uncovering the Hidden Forces That Keep Us Apart. She's also working on a follow-up book which examines the relationship between gender, race, and cultural perceptions of God. Christina, welcome back to Seminary Dropout.
Thank you for having me on again.
So I follow your Instagram account, which is such a joy.
Oh, thank you.
And because of that, I know, I mean, it's Instagram, so it's like, it's photo-based. So you get like clips of people's lives and not always like a full explanation. But I know that you recently went on a pilgrimage. What was the context of that?
Sure. Yeah, I went on a 5-week walking pilgrimage through central France in search of Black Madonnas, which are like ancient statues in mostly Catholic churches, but not exclusively, that depict Mary, the Mother of God, or some people would see her as God, as a Black woman, and typically she's with a Black baby Jesus. And so I walked about 400 miles. Many of these churches are in like really remote villages in the mountains. And so I got to be in my body and connect with people on the ground, and also come face to face with these just incredible images of the divine that as a Black woman were just really healing and meaningful for me.
I guess those are concentrated in France for some reason?
France probably has more Black Madonnas than any other country in the world, at least the famous ones. The Black Madonnas are typically Black female depictions of Mary that are associated with miracles. And so there are like tons of, you know, Black Marys around the world. But in terms of the famous ones that are like known for, you know, stopping a war or healing people, there are about 500 of those. And yeah, you know, over 100 are in France. So it certainly has a higher concentration than any other country. But there are lots in Italy. There are lots in Spain. They're actually all over the world. I mean, my mom and I went to visit one in Costa Rica last year. So they're all over the place. I'll be in London this summer speaking, and there are two in London. So, it's interesting that they are kind of spread out all over. Yeah, the reason I was in central France is like, there are probably like 65 in kind of like a 100-mile radius, which is just ridiculous. And part of that has to do with the fact that these are really a lot of the Black Madonnas were brought to Southern Europe through the Moorish influences. And so because so many of these areas in like Southern Italy, Southern France, Southern Spain were inhabited by the Moors for hundreds and hundreds of years, they were like Black populations or like heavily Black populations. And so you see lots of Black Madonnas that are left over from the influences of those times. And then also in this particular region that I was in France, it's a chain of volcanic mountains. And so a lot of the Black Madonnas were created by what we would consider to be like, you know, white Europeans, but they used materials that were right there, which was like really dark volcanic rock. And so they're Black because that's what they're created out of Black rock.
That's really fascinating.
And that's why there's so many where I was. Yeah. Yeah. It is really cool. It is really cool. But for like years, I mean, the pre-Roman people who lived there, you know, 2000 years ago, 3000, actually more than 2000 years ago, like 3000 years ago, they called that whole area the sacred forest because that volcanic rock was always seen as being connected with the like the dark divine feminine. And so it just made sense that they would create these statues out of, you know, these beautiful, dark, like volcanic rocks. And then the Catholic Church came along eventually and just sort of co-opted them, really. I mean, they're pre-Catholic. They're pre, really, any sort of or like institutional religion that we would recognize now. So really, no religion owns them in that sense. Although most of them do exist in Catholic churches right now.
So I'm guessing that has to, or has a connection with these Lenten reflections that you just you just went through, as Christ is our Black Mother.
Yeah, you know, I think my process of making peace with my evangelical background has been really different than a lot of the like folks who, so like the white people who've been talking about their evangelical background, for example, because so many of the conversations that have been led by folks about evangelicalism haven't had anything to do with race. Like maybe they've had something to do with gender, sort of on a more of like an abuse level, but no one's really been like addressing like the fact that God is like totally 100% exclusively male in evangelicalism. And also this bigger issue, not bigger, this other issue is that God is like seen as white. And, you know, I recognize some of these issues earlier on. And like, I know, like when I wrote a piece, I used to have an like a monthly column for Christianity Today magazine, like back in like 2015, 2016, something like that. And I wrote one piece about like how Jesus's skin color, like how Jesus wasn't white. It was like the least interesting statement, you know? And by the time the Christianity Today editorial staff had revised it, like it was even less interesting than my original piece, you know, like, so it should not have been shocking or scary or like, you know, uncomfortable for anybody to read this. Yet, like the response was just like horrific. I got like 6 or 7 like FBI certified death threats. Like there was all this drama. They were all coming to me at Duke because that was like, that's like my public address.
Sure.
And like I had students who were like not, they didn't want to go to class because they were afraid that we would get bombed or whatever, you know, which is like legit, you know, I'm not like, but it was just all this drama. And I just remember sitting there being like, dang, like evangelicals hate Blackness. Yeah. Like, I mean, because I didn't expect it to be like that intense. I expected to get some hate mail, like whatever. I always get hate mail, you know,
sure.
But like I wasn't expecting it to be that intense. And so I think I was aware on a level of how much like this spiritual community that's been really significant in my life. I mean, my first book is published in an evangelical press, you know, like all these things. And like, I was aware on some level that like, you know, there's evangelicalism is anti-Black. It just is. But I think it wasn't until the whole deal with Trump getting elected that I really integrated that with like how like evangelicalism is really anti-female, and anti-female, divine, like the divine feminine. And so I think through that process, cause I remember when like, you know, Trump was saying all the racist things, all the xenophobic things. And of course the evangelicals were like, oh my gosh, this is like, you know, we're going to make excuses for him. Right. We're going to be like, and then when that piece, that like, you know, news story came out that like he was talking about white women, like sexually assaulting white women. I was like, oh, for sure the evangelicals are going to protect their own women. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I was like, this is the end. Like, this is the end for Trump, because evangelicals are not going to let anybody do anything to their precious white women, you know? And then when I saw the like Trump apologetics around them, the apologists around that, I was like, damn, like, that was a really a turning point. And that's when I realized, oh my God, I've been writing about how much I hate white Christ, but I also hate male Christ for the same reason. I didn't know that, you know, like I didn't know that was just as violent, this sort of exclusively male Christ. And so that's where like, I really did this deep dive into Black Madonnas. It's just a starting point. In my public pilgrimage, was really like 2 years, more than 2 years after I had been really, in my opinion, devoted, you know, to the Black Madonna. But I was doing a lot of that sort of internally. So then this series I just did for Lent on Patreon around Christ our Black mothers, I guess just another, a continuation of that. Like, you know, how do we even begin to imagine? Because even if you look at a lot of the Black theology, Christ is still exclusively male in it. Christ is Black, but Christ is still exclusively male. And so, and then if you look at like Catholic feminist theology, Christ can be female, but it's always this implication that it's a white female Christ. And so not to say that I'm like the only person thinking about this, but because there weren't very many references and resources for me in my own journey, I felt like I needed to just do it for me. And I was grateful that so many people followed along on Patreon and were excited about it, or at least I don't know about excited, but yeah, I mean, supportive.
So connect the dots for some people between, like, for instance, the example you use, then Trump basically confessing to sexually assaulting women, white women, and having an exclusively like male view of God and who God is.
Yeah. You know, that's been so powerful for me to kind of go down that journey. So I think it has a lot to do with what we see as sacred. I think how we, you know, how inclusive our perception of God is going to impact how inclusive our perception of the sacred is. And I think in Western Christianity, where God is a white man, full stop, like that's it, you're only going to be sacred to the extent that you are, that you approximate that white man, or you're in proximity to that white man.
Oh yeah.
And so, like, you know, it's like a halo effect, right? Like the more you're able to be in that world, the more you're going to be seen as sacred. And it's just, so because the standard of what is sacred is white, is like white maleness. But I mean, it's not just white maleness in the sense that, like, it's really like a toxic masculinity and a white supremacy, right? I mean,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
If God were really just a white man and being a white man didn't mean anything in terms of power,
sure.
Then it wouldn't be a problem, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But because being a white man has so much to do with power and domination and dominance and colonialism, and even if you're not, even if that white man isn't intentionally practically engaging in that, the legacy is just overwhelming, right? And so I think because we associate God with that here in the West, and, you know, as I talked about a little bit on my pilgrimage, and as I like write in depth on this book that I'm working on, is it's like, you know, even if we're not explicitly making a connection between the divine and white men, it's implicit. It's everywhere. Like, I cannot pick up a dollar bill that doesn't have a picture of a white man and a line that says, "In God we trust," right beneath it. The picture of the white man.
like
you can't, it's everywhere in our society. And so this is just the way we've been shaped. And so as a result of that, if you're a white woman, you're going to be seen as less divine, less sacred automatically. And if you take into account race and gender, and you could also add sexuality to this, but because obviously if God's a white man, God's a heterosexual white man, but like just looking at race and gender right now, like, if you think of, like, you know, the closer you are to whiteness, the closer you are to maleness, the more sacred you're going to be, it makes perfect sense that Black women would be seen as the opposite of sacred, the opposite of divine, just from the divine. And with white women being in between. And so when I saw evangelicals not even defending their own white women, I was like, wow, like, maleness is trumping whiteness right now. And that's powerful. Yeah. it was interesting to be in the audience of that.
So, you came to Austin like last year, I want to say, about a year ago, maybe.
I think it might be a year ago now. Wait, you mean when I was there at Austin Community College last fall? I was there in September, but I spoke at Austin.
I think you're at some kind of like private school. I can't remember exactly.
Okay, so that was like the year before. Okay.
Gosh, that's been so long ago. Okay. Yeah. So I got to go and hear you speak, and you gave this.
Oh, you did? Oh, awesome.
Yeah. I was there. I said hi afterwards with a million other people who just wanted FaceTime with you. So you gave this great talk, and I hope that I can say enough to remind you of what it was about. But you told us about this study or experiment that was done where people were given. It was kind of like an IQ test or like some kind of intelligence test, but it wasn't real. It was
like a bogus IQ.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So did that jog your memory enough to know what that talk was about?
Yeah, I know the study.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Can you just briefly, summarize that real quick?
Sure. I think I was probably sharing the talk about, like the way so self-esteem and social identity go hand in hand. And
yes.
So this idea that if we're looking for a way to feel good about ourselves, the most effective way to do that is to derogate another group.
Yes.
A group to which we don't belong. And so I described this really famous study that was first published in the mid-90s, but has been replicated so many times. It's ridiculous. It's a very classic study of these faculty members who wanted to show that if someone has low self-esteem and you give them an opportunity to derogate a person in another group, then they will take it. They will take that opportunity, and it will also restore their self-esteem immediately. And it's like literally one of the most effective ways to restore your self-esteem. So the way that they manipulated people's self-esteem was by giving them a bogus IQ test, like a fake IQ test, where, you know, students at this prestigious college, you know, took this IQ test and then were given feedback that they had failed it. Not it was false feedback, but, you
right.
know, students believe a lot in a lab. And so that's like a reliable way to manipulate someone's self-esteem. Of course, after the fact, you debrief them and tell them about the deception. But in the moment, they believe that they failed the IQ test, and then their self-esteem takes a hit. And it's really predictable. So then you have all these people who have low self-esteem, and then you give them an opportunity to derogate somebody else. And they don't know it's an opportunity to derogate somebody else because it's framed differently. It's like, oh, hey, like now we're going to switch stuff. Studies here, and we're going to have you evaluate a job candidate for this position because we're interested in seeing how managers evaluate job candidates, you know. And so then what's interesting is to see how people who've had their self-esteem just taken a hit, they will negatively evaluate the job candidate if it's a member of another group. But if it's a member of their own group, they'll evaluate that person positively. And so in this particular study, in this iteration of it, it was around religion. So all the participants were Christian. And so they either got to evaluate a Jewish candidate or a Christian candidate. And so they were able to show, like, really predictably that if you have low self-esteem because you just bombed the IQ test and you're given a Jewish candidate to evaluate, you're going to evaluate that candidate negatively, even though that candidate is exactly the same candidate as the Christian one. And then they showed that their self-esteem rebounded. It was actually higher after negatively evaluating the Jewish person than it was at any point in the semester. Because they'd been taking their self-esteem measurements once a week throughout the semester, which is really common practice in psychology departments. So I think, you know, the power of that study, and one reason why I like talking about it, is because it just shows that so much of the way that we interact with the world is really about preserving our identity and our self-esteem. And if anybody challenges that, we're going to get on the deep end really quickly, right? So like even when I wrote that article about, you know, Jesus was not white, even though like most people should just be like, oh, yeah, I guess I hadn't really explicitly thought about it, but that makes sense. Like Jesus was Middle Eastern, right?
Right.
No, it's obviously way more complicated than that. We're not rational, because by saying Jesus is not white, now wait a second, I associated myself with Jesus. I was basking in reflected glory about that. and this is all non-conscious, of course.
Yeah,
but it's right. Like, you know, my self-esteem's taking a hit, therefore I will lash out at you. Like, it's almost like a reflex, you know. I will not stand for somebody negatively impacting my identity and my self-esteem. And so I feel like that study is just a good example of how defensive we are around ourselves, how defensive we are of our identities, how much we want to feel good about ourselves, and how much that motivates us. Yeah. To do things that probably we wouldn't like to do.
Yeah, totally. Well, and the crazy thing to me is that it works. Like, as in, their self-esteem really is elevated.
You totally feel good. Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know,
like, it's like so effective.
Yeah. When you were telling that here in Austin, you know, I don't think you drew direct lines to specific things going on, but it felt obvious to me. We were in the wake of Trump being elected, and also, you know, I think that the travel bans were much more fresh then. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's this scenario where we know for these people who voted for Trump because they say they didn't like illegal immigration, we can see the numbers on the page that the reason that they're not better off is not because of people taking their jobs or even, you know, a social safety net taxing them to death. Like, that's just not the case. And yet there was so much vitriol for immigrants, for Muslims, for people that did not look like them.
Yeah. And I think that's what's like, so I think that's what's so interesting about that study is that, like, when we are feeling on the defensive, when we're feeling insecure, when we're feeling like our identity is in question, that's when we're most likely to really do whatever it takes to rid ourselves of that discomfort. You know, part of it is like, we're just not really good at sitting with discomfort or like facing the truth, right? Whatever the truth is in that moment. And so I think what's so interesting is that Trump really in a powerful way tapped into that existential angst. The same existential angst that these, you know, prestigious college students had when it's like, well, wait a second, my whole life I've been told I'm awesome, and you just told me I failed this IQ test.
Yeah.
That's like, I'm having a, like, who am I if I'm not smart, right? Like, and I think that's similar, you know, that's the brilliance of, you know, Trump's approach, is that there are all these folks in the United States who are grappling with the reality that the world has changed a lot over the course of their lives. You know, I wrote a piece of when Trump was first running, I wrote a piece about why Trump was so relevant. I had just gotten back from a trip to Barcelona. Actually, that's my first trip to visit a Black Madonna. A friend and I went to go visit the Black Madonna of Montserrat, Spain, who's like super famous, and she's right outside Barcelona. And so we were there, and we were not at the Black Madonna, but when we were just walking through Barcelona, we ran into this like older white dude, definitely a baby boomer. And because he's American, we just started chatting with him. I think we were like, you know, commuting together or whatever on the train. And he was talking, and he was just like, yeah, like, you know, when I was growing up in the South, the only Black people I knew were the domestic workers in our house. Like, we didn't interact at all on any level. And he's like, when I was a little kid, I thought that Black people were brown because they were dirty, like they didn't take showers.
Oh, wow.
That was a level of like ignorance and lack of like connectivity in society.
Yeah.
And so then he's like, and he even said this himself. He's like, and now I'm sitting here on a vacation with you and you're a professor at Duke and like you could be my son's professor. You know what I mean? Like that's how much this world changed. And he wasn't saying any of this in a like inappropriate way. He was just observing like how much the world has changed.
Yeah.
And this is somebody who you know, probably is handling it better than most, right? But like,
yeah,
because he was like self-reflective and like self-aware, you know. But like, a lot of people are dealing, you know, a lot of white male baby boomers and just white people and just men, you know, are, and straight people and Christian people are dealing with this like world that has changed so much. And so it's that existential angst. Well, who am I if I can't guarantee that my child gets the position? Right? Like, who am I if I can't guarantee that my child is going to have the American dream, like a better life than me? Who am I if I can't guarantee that all of the displays in the holiday season in December are Christian? Like, you know, this existential angst where it's like based on dominance, but not really knowing that it's based on dominance. So Trump was so good because in the same way that these researchers recognize that, like, wow, people are like super vulnerable when they're dealing with this angst.
Yeah.
He's tapping into that. He's like, I have a solution. The solution is derogate somebody else. Mark Driscoll did the same thing 20 years ago. Exact same thing. Like, he tapped into existential angst around male toxic masculinity.
Oh, right. And it seemed,
right. You know, he did exact. I remember I lived in, Seattle for the summer of 2010. And I went to his church every single Sunday because I was just like, I want to know what's going on here. And I was sitting there and I'm like, wow, this is brilliant. Like, this guy's tapping into an angst, you know, and offering a solution. It's not a legit solution, but it's a short, it's a short-term feel good. Right. And so, and people just go for it.
Yeah.
Like,
I remember what you talked about. The moment with Trump when he admitted or was caught on tape talking about sexually assaulting white women, thinking that that was going to be the end of him. My moment was, I think it was before that, but it was when he started making fun of John McCain for being a captured prisoner of war during Vietnam. And I thought, oh, like, finally he's touched on something sacred for his base that is going to cause them to turn on him.
But that goes, oh my gosh, I'm so glad you're bringing this up because that, I had not thought about it that way. This is so helpful for me. That is why, so like on my pilgrimage, I use this term called white male God. It's all one word, lowercase, white male God. Hmm. And it's like the reason why the base turned on him, sorry, didn't turn on him with, it's because white male God is the standard and white male God dominates. White male God does not get captured.
Yeah.
And so like, if, so in that sense, John McCain, even though he's a white man, conforms less to the white male God ideal than someone who wouldn't have gotten captured. Because it's all about mastery.
Right. Right.
It's all about dominance.
Control, you know? And victory.
Winning.
Conquering.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And so he's always going to lose. You're always going to lose if you can't conform to that in the perfect way. Yeah, it's really interesting.
So the other thing I was thinking, and I thought this, that night that I was hearing you speak and give that talk, was that social psychology is in a way kind of close to being Christ-like. And what I mean by that is in Christianity, we're not allowed to just say people act like this just because they're garbage people and need to die. And we can't do that. And you can't do that in social psychology either. You have to say, no, like people were conditioned to act this way for a reason.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's definitely an attempt to like, I think there's definitely an attempt towards that sort of amoral, objective approach, you know, like trying to understand the humanity beneath people's decisions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, but just like Christianity, it's become, you know, it's subject to the whims of white supremacy and toxic masculinity. But
And people too are, in the same way that these people take this IQ test and are basing their value on it, like we take cues from the narratives that the world says about us. And
totally,
I've just thought a lot about how if you're, you know, if you're at the bottom of the privilege pyramid, if you're a black woman and the world says that you're nothing and that you're less than and you're garbage, well, Jesus has something to say about that. And if you're a white male and the world says that you're everything, that you're king, that you're God, well, Jesus also has a lot to say about that as well. And for a white male to, because of Jesus, you know, embrace our brokenness and humility, and for a white or for a black woman to embrace their power, embrace the fact that they're in the image of God, like those are both really kind of countercultural and revolutionary acts.
Yeah, I think it shows that, like, you know, I think it's that sort of awareness of, you know, how we've been shaped by society versus how we can be shaped by God. Yeah. And there's so much power in that, but there's so much healing and work for, you know, for all sides or all points of the ladder, of the social ladder, in terms of, you know, how do we right size ourselves? And for some folks that means stepping up and saying like, hey, like, I'm going to surround myself with people who can affirm the image of God in me. And that might mean leaving the church that I was raised in or whatever. Then for other folks, it might be, I need to surround myself with people who can tell me.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of toxicity that I've inherited and that I've, you know, by osmosis consumed. And yeah. And I love it when I see that happening. I don't see it happening very often, particularly for people closer to the top, because there's just so much incentive to stay at the top.
Yeah.
I don't see that, you know, it's hard to see.
Yeah. The making the actual choice to not just stay at the top, you know, not just believe those narratives that you got to the top because you were there, but then you have to, before you could even make that choice, you have to see it. and it's so often hard for people at the top to see that they are where they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know, and I think there's something about the way that we think about white male God too, that it's almost like, you know, the more distant you are from the bottom, the holier you are. So there's even an incentive to, like, I mean, I think in so many Western spaces that whether they're explicitly Christian or not, they're influenced by Christianity. And it's like, well, you know, being in the neighborhood where I'm distant from black transgender women is, that means I've made it. That means I'm blessed. Mm. That means I'm, you know, on the path that's right for me. And so I think it's really hard to even, as I talk about in my book, like, you know, this idea that, you know, white male God is like the Fortune 100 CEO. Like, do you think the Fortune 100 CEO is hanging out with the undocumented immigrants who clean the corporate headquarters at midnight? No. Like, that's the whole point of being the CEO, is that you don't interact with those folks. You're not all up in their reality. You actually benefit from their reality. And when we think about God that way as being really distant from the most desperate realities in our society, then we think it's good that we are too, you know? And so I think the social location of God is what the problem, or a problem, maybe not the problem, but is a problem. Why should I draw near if I don't even think God is near that?
I mean, I think to take Jesus seriously, it requires this like radical redefinition of power than what we've been told what power is. Because you're right, because power is, earthly power is like distancing ourselves from, you know, whatever, whoever society says is less than, and things that aren't glamorous. And
yeah. And it's just, So, and that's where I think it's just been really, I think that's what breaks my heart about Western Christianity, which, to be frank, is really just Christianity because of colonialism. I mean, I was in South Africa not too long ago in like the middle of a township full of colored folks. So that's like, you know, in South Africa, just for people who aren't aware, like in South Africa, there's like basically three races. It's white, colored, and black. And colored's like a mixture. It's more complicated than that, but like that, I'm oversimplifying, but that's kind of the way it is. So I was in this colored township. And there were all these white evangelical Western groups from America, like, you know, United States and Australia, who were there doing like, you know, so-called missions. And it's like, I was like, oh my gosh, like, I feel like you're just this, what I'm seeing in front of me is not Christianity. It's like Hillsong, you know, like it's, you know what I mean? Like it's, that's why I say like, it's not even just Western Christianity now, because we've colonized so many people through like worship music and through like Western speakers that have become globally known and all these things. And so like all over the world, you see this like distancing, this distancing of God from the people who are most, in my opinion, most purely bear the image of God. You know, like I think all of us bear the image of God in some ways, but so much of our power has occludes God's image or distorts God's image. And it's just, yeah, it's really interesting to see how, you know, it's so much beyond the Western church, but I would say, you know, it's like, it's something that we find here in the Western church where it's just really hard to even rethink who is Jesus. You know, I remember when I was teaching at Bethel 4 years ago, Bethel University, which is like a Christian college in St. Paul, mm-hmm. we were talking about like Jesus and, you know, what would Jesus do if Jesus, you know, what would Jesus do and say and be? And, you know, and it was so hard if Jesus were on earth right now. And it was so hard for my students to recognize that if Jesus were on earth right now, Jesus would be nowhere near Bethel. Like, you know, just the reality that Bethel A is literally on stolen Lakota land. B, it's like a place of power and privilege. It's where people are being educated to be the 1% of adults in the world who have a college degree. It's this like super Christian space, you know, and Jesus didn't really spend any time in religious spaces, like, you know, other than maybe every once in a while going into the temple to drop a bomb, you know,
or throw over a table. Tables, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so it's just interesting, just that reality, like how would we rethink the way that we do faith, those of us who do claim to follow Jesus, if we recognize that like we're the ones that Jesus would be condemning? Lovingly condemning, but condemning nonetheless.
Yeah. It sounds like a lot of the stuff that we're talking about and have talked about are the things that you cover in the book that you're writing right now.
Coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, this book yes. And also it's the most personal writing I've ever done. So a lot more of my personal story and like why, like the first half of the book is describing white male gods, tyranny in my life growing up. And the second half of the book, that's called He Who Was. And the second half of the book is She Who Is, where I construct a theology around God being a Black woman. So yeah, it is some of that. And it's a lot of what I'm talking about on Patreon too, ongoing. So
very cool. Yeah. So if people are interested in your seeing what you're doing on Patreon, is there a place they can go?
Yeah, they can go to just patreon.com/CSCleave.
Cool. I'll try to put up a link in the show notes to that.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Yeah, because cool. I'm doing this ongoing virtual pilgrimage around the Black Madonna where people can travel with me to all these places all over the world and think about God and race and gender through the lens of these Black Madonnas. So, yeah, the one coming out this month is on like the origins of a feminine God that have been really occluded. So I'm working on that right now. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. We'll put up a link in the show notes to that. Well, Christina, I just, ever since Disunity in Christ came out, like, that was just huge for me. I learned so much, and I've been following and learning so much from you ever since. And it's just an honor to have you. So thanks for being on Seminary Dropout.
Thanks. Thanks for allowing me to come on and talk about the things that I'm passionate about. I'm sure my passion came through. But yeah, thank you.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that's my best.